is emergence, and I hadn't worked on entanglement recently. So I decided to give a talk about some work from a few years back on entanglement, entropy, and the Kondo model. So there may be a few people here that have seen it before, including Paul, probably, who I suggest should leave immediately. So this is work that I did with Eric Sorensen, Ming-Cheng Chang, and Nicolas Lafrenci. So because there are quite a few people here who may not know what the Kondo effect is, I'm going to start by reviewing what it is, and then talk about something which may be a bit less familiar briefly, even for the experts, which is its realization in terms of spin chains. Then I want to just briefly introduce what I mean by quantum impurity entanglement entropy. It's actually a fairly general concept. And then discuss how it applies to the case of the Kondo model and what sort of new way of thinking about the Kondo effect this leads to. So first of all, Kondo effect in the screening cloud. So Kondo model is an incredibly simple model that math matter theorists have been studying for a very long time. It's a model for magnetic impurities in a metal. But one is studying this in the limit where the impurities are very dilute. So we have only a single magnetic impurity, S-imp. So this is a spin a half for the purposes of this talk, but in general it could be some other spin magnitude. We have a free conduction electron, so this dispersion relation could just be k squared over 2m, for example. We have a local interaction with the spin density. So S electron is the electron spin density, psi dagger, Pauli matrix times psi. At the origin with a Heisenberg-type SU2 symmetric interaction with the impurity spin. And we have some Kondo coupling constant J. And the sign of J will be very important, actually, and we'll assume it's positive corresponding to anti-ferromagnetic coupling. So local interaction with a single impurity. So it looks like an extremely trivial model, but we'll see, it has some interesting behavior. So we're generally interested in the case where the coupling is small. So these Kondo couplings are generally quite weak. So in that case, we can actually map this into a relativistic quantum field theory in one space and one time dimensions. And the first step in doing that is to take advantage of the fact that we have spherical symmetry here, and we have delta function interaction. So we can expand the fermion field in spherical harmonics, and only the S-wave harmonic interacts with the impurity. Furthermore, we can linearize our dispersion relation around the Fermi surface. We're dealing with a metal, so we have a non-zero Fermi surface. And then if we do that, this actually maps into a one-dimensional problem where we have basically spherical clouds of electrons coming in towards the origin where the impurity spin is scattering and going out. And the only non-trivial quantum mechanics involves the possibility of the spin of the impurity flipping during this interaction process and the spin being transferred to the conduction electrons. So this is the effect of Hamiltonian after linearizing the dispersion relation going back to position space. So we have left and right. So x really corresponds to radial coordinate. It's defined on the half semi-infinite line. We have left and right movers. And then we have this Kondo interaction with the impurity spin at the origin. And it's easy to see that when we make this S-wave projection and so forth, we automatically get a boundary condition at the origin that sets psi left equal to psi right. So the Kondo physics is fundamentally one-dimensional, regardless of what dimension we start in, two or three or anything else. So now a sidebar that is not so standard. First of all, we can use spin charge separation. That is to say, we can basically bosonize the fermions, and we can introduce separate bosons for charge and spin, and the Hamiltonian decouples into a charge part and a spin part. And I won't bother writing down the charge part because it doesn't couple to the interactions. And the spin part can be written in terms of basically J left and J right, which are left and right moving spin density operators. So this integral over R again goes from 0 to infinity. These J lefts and J rights are just spin densities for these left and right moving fermion fields, psi left and psi right. But now the important point is that we can actually get the same Hamiltonian if we start with a different model. Namely, we can start with a spin chain, a Heisenberg spin chain, a spin a half, with a weak coupling at one end. So here's the model here. So we have Heisenberg exchange interactions along a chain of some large length R. And the coupling is 1, but we have a weaker, well, it should be J, I guess, but we have a weaker coupling, JK, on the last site. So this spin at the end is weakly coupled to the rest of the chain. So this end spin is acting like the impurity spin, and the other spins are acting like the spin density for the conduction electrons. So you can also represent this in terms of bosonized field theory. In fact, this boson field theory is actually equivalent to the SU2 level 1 Bessemino-Witten model, if that helps. And these J's are the current operators in that model. And if you write down the spin part of the Hamiltonian for the free electrons, we actually get exactly the same Hamiltonian for the spin system. So even though this is an interacting spin system, we get the same spin part of the Hamiltonian as for the bosons, up to irrelevant operators. But actually, one of the operators is only marginally irrelevant. It's actually this dot product of J left and J right. And that doesn't fundamentally interfere with what's going on, but it's a bit inconvenient to have this marginal operator there because it leads to logarithmic corrections to almost anything. And if we're trying to do numerical calculations, they're kind of irritating. So we can actually get rid of this bulk marginal operator by adding a second neighbor coupling, and we can tune to a critical point. So a frustrating second neighbor coupling eventually leads to a transition into a dimerized phase. And if we go right at the critical point, where the second neighbor coupling is about 25% of the first neighbor coupling, then this marginal operator vanishes. So at that point, the correspondence to the free fermion Kondo effect is much better. It's not messed up by these log corrections. So this spin model is useful for several reasons. It's partly useful because some of the work I'm reporting is numerical, and it's much more efficient to do numerical work on the spin problem than the fermion problem. We have only 2 states per lattice site instead of 4 states. It turns out that it's, at least for DMRG numerical work, there's no simple way of taking advantage of the fact that we have free fermions. There is the NRG method, which does, but for these purposes, we're using DMRG, so it's more convenient to work with the spin system. Another thing is we can develop some intuitive pictures for what's going on in terms of ground states for spin systems, as we will see. So I think what makes this problem so interesting and surprisingly non-trivial is the fact that there's a renormalization of this Kondo coupling constant. So lambda here is a dimensionless Kondo coupling, this J times density of states. This has a quadratic beta function. So this effective coupling gets larger as we go towards low energies. So it's asymptotically free. So it's a bit like the coupling constant in quantum chromodynamics. So we have some sort of crossover from weak coupling to strong coupling behavior as we go from high energies to low energies. So we get the usual sort of flow of the coupling constant. And we can define a characteristic energy scale, which is called the Kondo temperature, which is exponentially small compared to the cutoff scale, which is like the bandwidth, exponentially small in the bare coupling. So this is like lambda QCD for the, that helps for the particle theorists. The renormalization group transformation involves reducing a cutoff. And basically, when we reduce the cutoff down to scales of order T Kondo, then the effective coupling becomes order 1. So this defines a sort of a crossover energy scale where we go into the strong coupling regime. And of course, this can be measured either in energy units or in momentum units. We just convert using the Fermi velocity. We have a characteristic momentum then at which the interaction becomes order 1. And if we just invert that, we have a characteristic length scale. So this CK is known as the Kondo length scale. And if you actually stick in the numbers for most experimental realizations, you get surprisingly large distances of order 0.1 to 1 micron, which is sort of huge on the scale of microscopic physics, sort of a mesoscopic scale. So you might ask, well, so what actually is the behavior at low energies? What happens when we go into the strong coupling regime? It's surprisingly easy to, in retrospect, at least after many years of arguments and brilliant theoretical contributions in the 70s, there's now a very simple picture of what happens at low energies. And it's best understood actually using a lattice model. In fact, the motivation for the lattice model is more or less exactly the same as the reason we use lattice gauge theory to understand how quantum chromodynamics behaves in the high energy regime. It's sort of simpler for understanding strong coupling. So if we take a lattice model like this, tight binding model, and we consider what happens when J is large, we can get a very simple intuition. So now we have fermions hopping on a lattice coupled to the impurity spin at the last site. So again, it's rather like the spin chain model, except now I'm back to free fermions again. So what happens at strong coupling? Well, if we just take the bare coupling to be strong, which is cheating slightly, we actually want a small bare coupling and a large normalized coupling. But just to gain intuition, we can imagine what happens if the bare coupling was large. Then this model is very easy to solve, because we can ignore T in first approximation. We only have to consider one lattice site. So if we just have one lattice site, conduction electrons here are coupled to the impurity spin, what is the ground state when J is positive? Well, I should have emphasized this point, by the way. J renormalizes towards large values when it's positive, which is the anti-ferromagnetic case. In the ferromagnetic case, it renormalizes to zero, a property of these quadratic beta functions. So we're interested in the case where J is positive. So what happens in that case? What is the ground state with one site for this Hamiltonian? Well, it's pretty obvious. There aren't too many, there are only eight states in the Hilbert space now. So the ground state will be the one where we have one electron sitting at site one rather than zero or two electrons. And it goes into a singlet state with the impurity spin. That will give us a negative energy for this term. So in other words, we can write the ground state this way. It's just up, down, minus, down, up. So it has a usual sort of entangled state involving two spin and halves. And in fact, if you want to understand the low energy effect of Hamiltonian, which is what this is actually good for, we're actually more interested in what the other electrons are doing. And the other electrons, now we put back the hopping term T, but we imagine it's small compared to J. We ask in more detail, what does the ground state look like, or the low energy excitations? Well, the answer is the other electrons can basically do anything they like. They can hop around on the other lattice sites. They can fill a Fermi C. There's only one thing they can't do. We can't allow any electrons to enter or leave the origin, because if they did, it would break up the Kondo singlet. Because if we have zero or two electrons at the origin, the total spin of the conduction electrons there will be zero. And if we're, the spin zero can't couple to the spin a half, it can't produce this large negative J energy. So in other words, we can't screen what's sometimes referred to as screening. We can't screen the impurity spin or form a spin zero unless we have exactly one electron at the origin. So the low energy theory just has free electrons with a kind of a boundary condition saying that they can't go to the origin. So that's equivalent to having just an infinite repulsion at J equals zero, not really any quantum mechanics anymore. There's no entanglement. We've already got rid of the impurity spin. All we have is a simple boundary condition or an infinite repulsion. And this is like a pi over 2 phase shift in scattering theory. But this was just a description when I took the Bayer coupling to be large. So I was actually cheating you, because we want the Bayer coupling to be small and the renormalized coupling to be large. So then we know that this picture I've been describing at best is only valid in a sort of long wavelength approximation. So it sort of describes the physics at low energies or sort of long distances. So how should we try to think about this in the problem of interest where the Bayer coupling is small? We have this characteristic length scale, CK. Well, the picture we have, again, is that there is an electron someplace which is forming a singlet with the impurity spin, but it can't be sitting on the next lattice site. We don't necessarily have a lattice in the problem anyway. And in fact, if we ask where it is, well, there's only one natural place for it to be, and it's far away, a distance of order CK, so maybe 0.1 to 1 micron away from the impurity spin. So we can think of some electron here which is somehow pulled out of the Fermi C and is got entangled over some very long distance, actually, with this impurity spin to form a spin singlet. And this whole low-energy description is only going to be valid, actually, if we probe the system to much longer length scales. So if you imagine coming in with some very long wavelength probe, you might sort of see just a screened impurity and just a pi over 2 phase shift. If you go inside the screening cloud, if you look at what happens at shorter distances, we have some complicated crossover physics, which can be studied using various numerical techniques and beta ansatz. So there's a version of this model which can be solved by beta ansatz, which is a very important development. So if we want to study the physics at low energies, as I mentioned, it's actually quite simple, because in lowest approximation, all we have is non-interacting electrons with a pi over 2 phase shift. If we want to go a little bit beyond that, we can ask, well, what are the corrections to this picture? So if our energy scale is small compared to TK, the impurity spin is gone from the effect of Hamiltonian. It's connected with high energy excitations of order T Kondo. But there are some residual low energy excitations, which correspond to the leading irrelevant interaction near this stable fixed point. And these are basically induced interactions among these low-energy electrons. So apart from the pi over 2 phase shift, we also have some induced interactions. These interactions are actually they're quartic and fermion operators. And furthermore, they're local. So these interactions only occur at the origin, because everything in this problem is local. That is to say, at one point in space. So just by inspection, the leading irrelevant operator we can write down that preserves all the symmetries and furthermore is only in the spin sector is precisely the square of the this spin density operator JL. Remember, we have this boundary condition Actually, I think the pi over 2 phase shift sticks a minus sign into the boundary condition, which I omitted here. But anyway, we can write this in terms of just the square of the spin density. So this is the leading irrelevant operator. This is dimension 2 operator, and it's at the origin, so the coupling constant has to have dimensions of length. So just by dimensional analysis, the length scale which should come in here is the largest one available, namely Ck. So if I put a precise, say, 1 over pi here, I'm just giving a precise definition of Ck. And there are actually many definitions on the market. This is just one which is convenient. So now we can calculate the low-energy, long-distance properties of the model by doing perturbation theory in this interaction. And it's an irrelevant interaction. It's dimension 2, and it's local, so that means it's irrelevant. And we can just calculate things in a series, and powers of Ck are equivalently 1 over Tk, 1 over the Kondo temperature. So this is known as a Fermi liquid theory, because we have free fermions up to some interactions which are irrelevant, and we can do perturbation theory in them at low energies. So, for example, if we calculate the magnetic susceptibility induced by the impurity, a lowest order contribution actually is first order in Ck. That gives us 1 over 4 Tk. The 1 quarter is just conventional because I stuck the pi here. It's the definition of Tk. Then we can go to higher orders, and we'll get a series in powers of T over Tk. So basically, any low-energy property can be calculated as a power series in T over Tk, or equivalently Ck over some long length scale, as long as we're in this low-energy regime. Okay, so what about entanglement? So we decided to try to understand how the entanglement properties of the fermions are modified by having an impurity spin present. Part of the motivation actually was a general formula from Cardi and Calabresi, which will appear in a minute. But what kind of entanglement am I talking about here in general? Well, it's usual entanglement entropy. I'm defining it using natural logs, so you see some log 2s floating around. In the general cases, I want to consider some region, some imaginary region of size little r, which contains the impurity, and consider its entanglement with the rest of the system outside this region, which could be infinite or could be finite. So we could think about this in the, say, three-dimensional metal. So we have the entire system could be, for example, a three-dimensional sphere. I'm drawing some imaginary three-dimensional sphere of size little r, which contains the impurity. Or in the one-dimensional spin chain context, for example, I consider the entanglement of some finite region of size little r with the rest of the system, with the impurity sitting at the end of the chain. So Cardi and Calabrese predicted that for conformal field theory in one dimension, defined on the half line with a conformally invariant boundary condition, in general, the entanglement entropy has this form. So this log R term is pretty familiar and involves the conformal anomaly parameter C. But they also observed there should be another term, which in fact is independent of R and is conventionally written as log of G. And in fact, this log G term showed up many years earlier. And Ludwig and I observed that it's a universal term in the thermodynamic entropy of conformal field theories. It also shows up in condensed matter applications. So it's a term in the entropy of the conformal field theory that doesn't depend on the length of the system when you have a semi-infinite system with a boundary. So it's a kind of additional contribution to the thermodynamic entropy, which is connected with having an impurity of some sort or some sort of conformally invariant boundary condition. So we called it log of G because G was supposed to be the analog of some degeneracy of the ground state. But so in simple examples like the one I'm discussing, G will simply be an integer. But there are known non-trivial conformal field theories where G is not necessarily an integer. So it's like having a fractional degeneracy in the ground state associated with having the impurity. Of course, it's only possible because the impurity is interacting strongly with a conformal field theory. And one has to define this carefully by taking the limit of length going to infinity first before taking temperature towards zero. So one can characterize any conformally invariant boundary condition by a value of this degeneracy parameter G. And Cardi and Calabresi argued that this log G term should be here. There's also this non-universal parameter A, which looks like it's going to shift G, and indeed that's true. So in fact, one can only actually detect this term if one compares two different conformally invariant boundary conditions. So if now we compare this entanglement entropy with two different boundary conditions, we would expect to see some change in the entanglement entropy of order 1. In fact, if we have some sort of normalization group flow, between different conformally invariant boundary conditions, we would expect to see a change in order one of the entanglement entropy, which actually measures the change of this parameter G, which actually labels these conformally invariant boundary conditions. So the Kondo model is about the simplest, most trivial model we can write down that exhibits such a change of this entropy. And in fact, this degeneracy is 2 at the weak coupling fixed point and is 1 at the strong coupling fixed point. In other words, if you just plot the thermal entropy in the Kondo model versus temperature, it looks something like this. This is something which is actually measured in experiments because the entropy can be determined by integrating the specific heat. So this is actually something which has been seen, calculated in beta ansatz, seen in experiments. I'm not sure I drew the curve exactly correctly. But important point is at high temperature, it goes to log 2, and at low temperature, it goes to 0 linearly. So why is this? Well, remember, we're talking about the limit of a very weak bare coupling. And at high temperature, the coupling constant is essentially 0, or it's the bare coupling. And in that limit, we have a spin and a half impurity, which is just decoupled from everything else. So therefore, it has a twofold degenerate ground state, up or down. So that gives us an entropy of log 2. On the other hand, as we go to 0, this impurity spin is forming a singlet with conduction electrons, so we've quenched this entropy of the impurity, and therefore this goes to 0. And the fact that it actually goes to 0 is T, this should be T sub K. So the fact that it goes to 0 is T over TK is, again, a result of doing perturbation theory in the leading irrelevant operator. So that's why we conclude that G goes from 2 to 1 as we go from one fixed point to another. So we should expect a change in this entanglement entropy by log 2, according to this argument. So I should emphasize here that what I'm talking about is not actually the entire entanglement entropy. If I consider the entire entanglement entropy, most of it actually is not this impurity term. In the one-dimensional case, most of it is a log R term. And in the three-dimensional case, most of it will be an R squared term connected with the boundary of the sphere. But what I'm imagining is trying to calculate the change in the entanglement entropy when I stick in or take out the Kondo impurity, or the change in this entropy when I go from some effectively strong or effectively weak bare coupling to a strong bare coupling. And in fact, this is precisely analogous to something which is routine in the Kondo industry and what people measure in experiments. So for example, when people measure thermodynamic entropies or thermodynamic specific heats, experimentally, they'll measure the specific heat with a bunch of impurities in the sample. They'll subtract off the specific heat without the impurities. They'll divide by the number of impurities. And if their system is dilute enough, the result scales linearly with impurity number. And therefore, they can measure the impurity contribution to a thermodynamic quantity like the thermodynamic entropy. So we're defining an entanglement analog of that quantity. And this other point is, well, not too important. So let me first of all talk about a simple case, which is R equals 0. So now I'm not considering entanglement as some region containing the impurity, but only the entanglement of the impurity itself with the rest of the system. So this is something which actually we looked at a long time ago. And it's actually quite trivial to see that this, I'll call it little s, so this doesn't depend on any length scale little r, this entanglement of the impurity itself with the rest of the system can be easily related to the magnetization of the impurity. And why is that? Well, there are two cases to consider here. Let's take the case where R is even. So now I'm just trying to represent the ground state, the exact ground state. Now, nothing based on RG. This is an exact statement. So if I try to write down the exact ground state for the system with either an even number of sites or an odd number of sites in the one-dimensional language or even an odd number of electrons inside my finite sphere in the three-dimensional case, well, what do I know about the system? Well, I know that the ground state for an even number of sites is spin zero. And if I try to make a spin zero ground state out of a single spin a half and then an odd number of other spin a halves, well, there's only one way of doing it. I have to have the rest of the system has to also be in a spin a half state. And I can just make a combination up, down, and minus down, up. On the other hand, if I have an odd number of sites, which is more interesting, then the ground state will have spin a half. So if we take, for example, the SZ equals 1/2 element of the ground state doublet, then again, there are only two possible states that can contribute to it. The impurity spin could be up, and then the rest of the system has to be in a singlet state. Or the impurity spin could be down, in which case the rest of the system has to be in a spin 1 state, and furthermore with an SZ of plus 1. I have some unknown coefficients A and B that tell me about the mixing of these two contributions. So in terms of A and B, or 1 and minus 1, I can easily calculate both the magnetization of the impurity, and also the entanglement entropy. These immediately lead to the formula written here, namely this entanglement entropy is directly expressed in terms of this impurity part of the magnetization. So when R is even, this impurity magnetization is zero. The impurity is equally likely to be up or down in the singlet ground state, and therefore I get a log 2 entanglement. So I get a maximal entanglement, as you might expect, when I have an even number of sites and I've formed a spin singlet. The case of R odd is more interesting and a small bare K. This got a little bit screwed up. So then the question is, what is the magnetization of the impurity when I have an odd number of sites? And that actually depends on whether I'm in the weak coupling regime or the strong coupling regime. So in the weak coupling regime, actually, there's a net magnetization of 1/2 in the system. And at weak coupling, it's all carried by the impurity. So therefore, this impurity magnetization is going to be 1/2 when the effective coupling is weak. And this implies zero entanglement, so the impurity is simply pointing up. On the other hand, if I'm in the strong coupling regime, this 1/2 magnetization is carried all across the chain, and the magnetization of the impurity is going to zero. In that case, the impurity magnetization goes essentially to zero, and therefore I get an entanglement which is log 2. So as we increase the size of the chain for odd R, we would expect to go between 0 and log 2 entanglement. And that's what the numerical data is showing here. One of the things that we were trying to understand in this project was universality behavior and scaling, and whether we get nice scaling curves or not. This is not a nice scaling curve, not like the ones I'm going to show you later. Data for different bare couplings don't match onto a smooth curve. This is also actually understood, because in this case, we don't expect this magnetization of the impurity to be a pure scaling function. And technically, this is because if you write down the renormalization group equations, you discover that the impurity spin actually has an anomalous dimension. And that implies that all dependence on the bare coupling doesn't actually vanish here. This can mess up scaling when we're dealing with bare couplings that are not totally negligible. On the other hand, if we look at the this entanglement entropy when R is large compared to 1, then the anomalous dimension of this impurity operator doesn't come in, and we expect to get pure scaling functions. And indeed, that's what we found numerically. So this graph is a bit busy. Let me walk you through it. So this is this is the impurity part of the entanglement entropy. For various values of little r over big R, that's my imaginary region A to the total system size. So for each of these graphs, it's held constant. And what we're plotting here is plotting all the data as a function of little r over Ck. So Ck is the Kondo screening cloud size. Little r is the region of this size of this region A. And we have data for many different values of bare Kondo coupling, so many different values of Ck. And the important thing is that all these data collapses onto a single curve for each value of little r over big R. So the curves are going from large system sizes, so this ratio is 1/10, 1/5, 1/3. And the upper panel is even R, lower panel is odd R. So important point is that we can collapse all the data onto a single curve in each case. Now, of course, we have a little bit of freedom here, because for each value of the bare coupling, we could choose a Ck. But this shows the CKs we chose. And in fact, they're completely consistent with the expected exponential form of the dependence of the screening cloud size or the Kondo temperature on the bare coupling. And furthermore, we have good collapse for many values of little r over big R. So this is actually a very nice collapse. So what this is telling us is that this impurity entanglement entropy is, in fact, a universal scaling function. So it doesn't really depend on three parameters. It only depends on two parameters, namely the ratio of little r over big R and the ratio of little r over CK. We also see, perhaps surprisingly, that there's a big difference between the case of even and odd R. So entanglement entropy behaves very differently. That's especially true in this limit where R is small compared to Ck, which is sort of going towards the weak coupling limit. Also, as I'll mention shortly, if we look at what happens in the limit where R over Ck is large, we recover a conformal field theory prediction. And in fact, in that limit, the prediction works both in the case of even and odd capital R. So one of the things that was not actually captured by what I've said so far about the conformal field theory was this perhaps surprising difference between even and odd R. But one can develop an intuitive picture about this, and perhaps an intuitive picture about the Kondo effect in general, in terms of valence bonds. This is based on thinking about the ground state for the spin-1/2 chain. So if you try to write down a ground state for a spin and half chain, it's well known that you can represent it by some valence bond configurations. So what do these configurations mean? Well, whenever I draw a line, it means I'm forming a spin singlet between the spins and those lattice sites. And in fact, for, in general, for a spin and half chain with a singlet ground state, we can simply contract all pairs of spins in arbitrary ways in valence bonds. And if we sum over all configurations, this will give us the most general singlet state, including the ground state. And it's easy to see that there's enough redundancy in this basis that we can avoid writing any crossed valence bonds. We can write entirely non-crossed bonds. So this would be a ground state. So the ground state would be a linear combination of terms like this for an even number of spins. For an odd number of spins, we have one spin which is not involved in a valence bond. We have one spin, in fact, which is pointing up, for example, if we take the SZ plus 1/2 ground state. So now an important issue for this entanglement entropy is whether or not we have a valence bond which actually couples to the first lattice site, which I guess is called 1 or called 0 at various points in this talk. Sorry about that. And I should say at this level I'm starting to be extremely heuristic. So this is just a hand-waving argument, some effort to understand the difference between even odd and odd R. So anyway, I'm going to refer to the valence bond connecting the origin, the spin at the origin, which is supposed to be the impurity spin, with some other spin in the chain as the impurity valence bond. So for an even number of sites, there must be an impurity valence bond, because we do have a spin singlet. And in fact, we can think of the other spin here, which is forming this impurity valence bond, as being this electron that was forming the spin singlet. So the Kondo screening cloud is basically involves the other end of this impurity valence bond. On the other hand, when I have an odd number of sites, I may or may not have an impurity valence bond, because this decoupled spin could, in fact, be the spin at the origin. And this is related to why the behavior is so different for even or odd system size. And now I'm going to heuristically try to identify the impurity entanglement entropy as being log 2 times the probability of having an impurity valence bond that stretches from region A to region B. So I've got some imaginary line here which separates region A and B. And this impurity valence bond might or might not stretch all the way from region A to region B. Very heuristically, we'll say, well, in cases where it does stretch, we get a log 2 contribution. In cases where it doesn't stretch, we don't. But then we have to average over all the states making up the ground state. Now, I emphasize this is heuristic, partly because this is not actually an orthonormal basis of states, and nobody's really figured out how to do calculations in this basis for entanglement entropy. If someone did figure it out, it would be useful not only for this problem, but for various other ones. So at this level, I'm being very heuristic. But now we can understand, at least qualitatively, the behavior of these curves, because, we expect that the typical length of the impurity valence bond will be the Kondo screening cloud size, CK. So in the case where R is even and we always have an impurity valence bond, things are relatively simple. This entanglement entropy simply decreases monotonically with R, and the sort of scale over which it decreases is CK, because once we take the region R to be large compared to CK, most likely the impurity valence bond ends inside the region A, and we don't get any extra entanglement of region A to region B coming from having this impurity spin present. On the other hand, the case of R odd is more complicated and interesting because we don't necessarily have an impurity valence bond and therefore nothing to give the extra entanglement. And if we take the limit where we have zero coupling, in that limit, this impurity entanglement entropy is actually zero. So for zero coupling, basically what happens is this impurity spin is always sitting at the end, because if you try to make the ground state when you have zero coupling of this site with the rest, then the rest of these spins will go into a spin zero state, and the spin half is residing at the end. That's the case where the impurity magnetization is 1/2. So in that case, we have no impurity valence bond, no entanglement. So now as we start to increase the Kondo coupling, that means we're decreasing CK. Now two things are going on at once. So as we increase the Kondo coupling, it gets more and more likely that we actually have an impurity valence bond, as I've drawn here. But at the same time, when we have it, it gets shorter. So these two effects can trade off. If you, for example, then look at what happens for fixed R over R, as you vary, for example, CK from being much larger than the system size where the effect of coupling is weak to being much smaller than the system size where the effect of coupling is small, then we see that because of this interplay of these two effects, we can reasonably expect to get a maximum in this impurity entanglement entropy when the CK is basically of order the system size. So that's sort of balancing the possibility of actually having an impurity valence bond with the likelihood of it stretching all the way from region A to region B. And this is in the case where I'm holding little r over big R fixed. And that, in fact, is consistent with the data, because Inchet here shows the maximum value of R over CK plotted versus R over R, and we see that it's linear, so that indeed supports this crude picture. In some limit, at least, we can actually calculate using conformal field theory what this entanglement, impurity entanglement entropy looks like. So we do it using this Fermi liquid theory. So we have otherwise free fermions, and then we have this interaction term involving J left dot J left at zero. And in fact, this is actually a very simple calculation for us because Cardi and Calabresi had done all the hard work earlier. And the key thing to notice is that this leading irrelevant operator is actually the Hamiltonian density at the origin. So this is a very simple kind of local perturbation. We're just perturbing the system locally by the Hamiltonian density. And in fact, this is a kind of universal perturbation which exists in absolutely any boundary conformal field theory. It's always possible to add the energy density at the origin because this always respects all symmetries of the problem, of course. And that, in fact, is precisely the leading irrelevant operator in this particular model, which is what really makes it so simple. So in fact, to calculate the entanglement entropy, we basically need to do perturbation theory in the energy density at the origin. So following Cardi and Calabrese, we can obtain the entanglement entropy using the replica trick from a partition function Zn on an n-sheeted Riemann surface with the sheets joined on a cut between 0 and R. And Cardi and Calabresi argued that, in fact, they argued that they could relate this entanglement entropy to certain Green's functions involving some peculiar operators phi n, which depended on the number of sheets of the Riemann surface. And as an intermediate step in the calculation, they actually had to consider the three-point function of phi n with the energy density. So they calculated actually exactly the Green's function we need because it's exactly this Green's function which determines lowest order perturbation theory in T. So going through the calculation, we can immediately conclude that this enlarged distances, so in the region where CK is small compared to R, so we're well below the Kondo temperature, we're in the long distance limit where the Fermi liquid theory applies, we can do this perturbation theory to lowest order. And this gives us an explicit prediction for this entanglement entropy, and it predicts that it should go to zero like CK over R. And having defined CK in a precise way to fix the susceptibility, for example, the coefficient comes out to be pi over 12. We can easily extend this is for the case of an infinite total system size. We can easily extend this to a finite system size by making a standard conformal transformation. And then the prediction is that for a finite value of R, but in the limit where CK is small compared to little r, and therefore also big R, we get this particular standard result from a conformal transformation. So the solid line here is the prediction from conformal field theory of what this impurity entanglement entropy should look like as a function of little r for a fixed value of big R, large values, and in fact taking CK to be very small. And this is, there's two curves for R of 400 or 401. So we have these huge system sizes which can be studied using DMRG. And we get actually beautiful agreement in this case over almost all values of R of the conformal field theory prediction with the data. So let me finally just put up some conclusions. So I hope I've convinced you that impurity entanglement entropy is a useful probe for quantum impurity problems. I've given you a very simple example, but actually we can apply this to any other type of problem involving quantum impurities, and many of them have much more interesting behavior than the simple Kondo model. We've also seen by explicit examination that this impurity entanglement entropy is a universal scaling function of R over CK and R over R. I say this follows not only from the fact that we got nice data collapse in these curves, but also that the predictions that were made using the free fermion standard Kondo model also apply to the spin chain version of the Kondo model, which is another realization. So microscopically, it's completely different, but nonetheless, one gets the same kind of behavior. I guess I should have mentioned this point. If we look at the curves here, first of all, If you take the limit where big R goes to infinity, the difference between even and odd R disappears. We get a universal curve, which in fact starts to approach this one. And this curve is actually decreasing from log 2 when we're deep inside the screening cloud, so when our imaginary region of A is much smaller than the screening cloud size, so that the impurity valence bond is reaching outside, to the outer limit where R is much less than CK, where it's not reaching outside and it's going to 0. So we're crossing over from log 2 to 0, which is exactly the prediction of Calabresi and Cardi. So this CFT prediction indeed seems to work. And finally, we've checked and demonstrated that this impurity entanglement entropy is given by a simple analytic expression, which is based on combining this Fermi-liquid technique for the Kondo problem with this perturbation theory that Cardi and Calabresi did for this replicated Riemann-sheeted partition function. And it works in this limit where CK is much less than R, which is where we can justify this Fermi-liquid theory. So that's it. Thank you.
Can I add a word?
In the case say of the two-channel Kondo problem, this would have a non-trivial boundary condition.
Yes.
So what happens with the calculation of entanglement?
Yes. So I think one could easily repeat this for the two-impurity case. In fact, you can actually do it by just taking a spin chain where the impurity spin is in the middle instead of at the end. In this case, it should be a crossover from log 2 to 1 half log 2, because that's the known...
I would naively expect that you would get the g-factor.
Yeah, the g-factor goes from 2 down to log to square root of 2.
So what would be the...
So we should say a drop. The drop in the entanglement entropy should be by 1/2 log 2 instead of log 2 in that case. We haven't done this calculation yet, but it's a straightforward extension of what we've done. And there are lots of other examples we can think of that would exhibit various fractions. Okay.
Is there any hope of being able to complete the whole curve using beta?
We haven't tried, but it would be an interesting thing to do. We believe it's a universal scaling function. But how to do it?
Can you relate it in some, maybe not easy, but direct way to the sort of a free energy kind of thing?
Well, actually, based on Karin the Hirsch talk, maybe we can somehow relate it to this number fluctuation. But I don't know if you've understood rigorously if that's exactly correct. But it's somehow, the number fluctuation picture is also related to this valence bond picture, because think of entanglement as occurring from particles hopping back and forth from region A to region B. A particle being there or not being there is like a spin up or a spin down. So every valence bond is like a particle going back and forth. There's some intriguing connection. I don't know how to rigorously handle
the analytic continuation there. Is in space, there is in time.
Kevin's idea is also in space. She's looking at number of fluctuations in
space. Space as well.
Okay, let's thank the speaker again.